I'm very happy now to welcome Tony Gerlich. He is a longtime educator, founder of Monte del Sol Charter School, and now he's the new principal learner at the Mandela International Magnet School. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Now, you have been in the education business for a long time. Did you start as a teacher?
I did. Actually, I started as a volunteer, as a member of the Jesuit Volunteer Corps way back when, and I volunteered in the inner city in Portland, Oregon at the Public Defender's Office. Was all set to go to law school when I had a change of heart and became a teacher, and that's what set my career off. So for a brief interlude, yes, I've always been an educator.
What were your early teaching experiences like? Did you stay in the inner city of Portland?
I did. I taught 2 years in the inner city of Portland. My very, very first teaching job was at an international school in Cochabamba, Bolivia, back in 1977 until 79. And that was a fabulous experience, and I think really had a part to play in why I have stayed in education all these years. It was fabulous.
What was it like?
Well, it was a very small school. Bolivia was not a common destination for tourists and travelers. The international school there had quite a few United Nations projects going on. The Danes were there, I remember. There was some oil exploration going on, but really there were a lot of economic development agencies that were there, and enough to have an international school. And so the school was lovely. It was very small and intimate, and in those days, I taught 5 classes of mathematics and 1 of U.S. history and got paid very little money and enjoyed every single minute of it.
What is an international school? Your new school that you are starting, the school in Bolivia, what does that term mean?
Great question. It can mean different things in different settings. That school in Bolivia, I've also taught at an international school in Lima, Peru, and also was a principal of an international school in Santiago de Chile, most recently in Warsaw, Poland. All of those schools had uniquenesses to them. The school in Bolivia, I think, was set up, like so many international schools, for people that work in the global economy, and they are there for a variety of reasons. In Bolivia, they had a lot of United Nations projects happening. In Santiago, Chile, that country was developing rapidly. There are lots of businesses relocating to Chile from all over Latin America and North America. In Poland, same thing was happening as well as that country was emerging. In the United States, to call yourself an international school can sometimes mean that people coming from outside the country looking for a school for their children. They may not be from the United States. In Santa Fe and in other places where that's not the case, it means that there's a focus curricularly and culturally on cultures other than the United States, other than what we're familiar with, the teaching of language, the international perspectives that a curriculum can bring. And in our case, using the International Baccalaureate curriculum, all of those factors would combine to call ourselves an international school.
What is the International Baccalaureate designation? What does that mean?
The International Baccalaureate designation means that we are utilizing their program. It's not really a curriculum. And when I get asked that question, it's really a method of teaching and learning and thinking. It is a program that fosters internationalism, global-mindedness, and there's an interesting history to the IB. It was begun in the early 60s by a group of visionary educators who thought that the world desperately needed some educational program that brought people together after World War II and really taught how to live together, how to be together, how to think together, and how education could be used for the betterment of humankind. That theory remains in the IB, and it's certainly one of the reasons that I'm excited about starting a new school with that kind of an ethos, with that kind of a philosophy, because we desperately need as many examples as we can of an education that fosters strong academic achievement within the context of what do we do with this education, if not to better the world in somehow. And all of that is consistent with an IB philosophy.
So when you talk about world betterment, do you have a public service component in the teaching?
There is an action-oriented component to the IB that has to be present in the IB in order for your eventual certification by the organization. And actually, if you think of the IB pushes three general component areas. There is inquiry, which is a great place to start any educational process. Then there's learning and action, and then there is reflection. And think of that as a circular cycle, inquiry, action, reflection, inquiry, action, reflection. Inquiry leads to learning, learning leads to action, reflection leads to how do we do it better? What worked, what didn't, etc., more inquiry, and so on, and so on. So yes, there will be a service component, an action component. We are very, very interested in using the model that we established at the Monte del Sol Charter School, the mentorship model, which is a fabulous program, and we will utilize that model as part of our action component as well.
Tell us more about the mentorship model.
The mentorship model that we birthed at Monte del Sol asked a fundamental question of students, and that is, what are you interested in? What are you passionate about? And most young people aged 12 to 18, many of them will say, well, I don't know, necessarily. Many of them would, actually. They said, I'm really interested in music.
Or you might say that at 35.
You might say that at 35. That's right. And mentorship at age 35 could be just as valuable, too. But particularly for young people who tend to grow up sometimes disconnected from adults other than their families or their schools. Mentorship was a way of connecting kids to the community through a mutual shared passion and a mutual shared interest, adult to student, that they got together with that common glue of that shared interest and passion, and off they went exploring that shared interest and passion. And then at the end of the year, they presented their findings and their learnings in a portfolio, in a presentation to the community at our celebration of learning that we held every year for 3 days, where everybody presented their projects, and they received high school credit for it, and it was a fabulous program.
What are some examples of mentorships that people did that you remember?
Oh, yeah, there's some highlights at the very, very high end, and what I mean at the high academic end. We had a brilliant student who was very interested in chemistry, had always been interested in chemistry, and high-level chemistry. And we found him a mentor from the labs, a retired scientist, and they really clicked. And off they went investigating polymer chemistry. And polymers are molecule bonds that create lots of things. And this project took this student into very, very deep recesses of polymer chemistry, enough so that he eventually went to MIT, and the MIT admissions committee said, we were incredibly impressed by this mentorship. So that's at the very high end.
Yeah.
But we also had incredible stories of kids that initially said, well, I don't know what I'm interested in. But we hooked them up with a mentor, and they became interested in it, whatever it was. Could be working in a veterinary office, or if you go out to Monte del Sol today, out in the Nava Ade housing districts, you'll see as you drive in a very large 15-foot iron sculpture that sits there in the front. And that was a student who didn't know what he was going to do, but he hooked up with a fabulous metallurgist artist here in Santa Fe, and off they went and resulted in this beautiful sculpture as another example.
To me, that's an illustration of how important relationships are in learning.
Couldn't agree with you more, Mary Charlotte. There's no learning that happens without relationship, in my view. The relationship between a student and a teacher, the relationship between a student and the subject, the relationship between the teacher and the subject, the relationship of the school to the student, all of it is about relationships.
And the relationships among the students themselves.
Absolutely. The community that's established and the supportive nature of learning. Very hard to take risks intellectually if you know you're going to fail and be made fun of, or you know you're going to be reminded of your own inadequacies. Well, we're all inadequate. And if you can create that community where it's just great to take a risk, it's great to fail in your pursuit of knowledge, then that's the value of relationships.
And it's interesting and I think difficult because certainly in your high school years, or if I can recall my own schooling, any years at all, there's always somebody ready to make fun of you.
Yeah, it's endemic to the age, and we certainly hear stories of the deleterious effects of that kind of picking and bullying. Doesn't mean it has to be. We have plenty of examples of schools, and that's why I'm such a fan of small schools, because the potential of small schools to create welcoming environments, nurturing environments where everyone is accepted is high.
Define small.
Well, my definition of small is small enough so that I know every kid. And for me, 360, which is what we had at Monte, will have slightly less, maybe around the same at the Mandela International Magnet School, is about my capacity to know everyone well.
Yeah.
Another measure might be, 60 kids in a class, they can all fit on a bus, those sorts of things. That's what I would consider. So now the state has some fiduciary definitions of small schools. If high schools are under a certain number, they receive a small school supplement in their funding. So there are some legal definitions as well. But for me, that's sort of the cultural line.
Now, what about class size?
Yeah, class size is critical as well. You can find research all over the place on all sides of that matter. There is research that says class size doesn't matter. It's the quality of teacher matter. There's research that says class size matters greatly. In my view, it's, and I'm biased, I fall clearly on the side of smaller class sizes. I think smaller class sizes allow teachers to delve into thinking of students better. It allows a teacher to develop those relationships that we just referred to better. It allows teachers to get to know students well enough so that they know how to guide those students in a line of questioning better. And that's been my experience. There's no question that in all of that research, the one common theme and one common denominator is a quality educator. If you have small class sizes and a not quality educator, doesn't make any difference, quite frankly.
How do you evaluate teachers? If you're in the position of being the principal of a school and hiring teachers, how do you decide on quality?
Try as hard as we might. There are and there are not objective scientific ways of measuring effectiveness, and there are non-scientific ways of measuring effectiveness. It is true that we need desperately to ensure that our kids know how to read, know how to write, know how to articulate well, know how to think, and that all of us have to struggle with some ways of measuring progress on those things, whether they're standardized tests, whether they're what we call formative assessments, where a teacher is constantly gauging the learning of a student and then adjusting their teaching based on where a student is. That to me is an incredibly, it's an art form to do that well. And when I am in classrooms and working with teachers and I see a teacher who really knows their student well and knows that Juancito needs to go in this direction or Johnny needs to go in that direction and therefore teaches a little bit more towards that student's direction, that's art form. That's a skill. And that for me is high quality. I place a very, very high premium on feedback. Feedback, in my experience, has been extremely helpful in the learning of a student.
And who's feeding what back to whom?
The teacher is feeding back to the student. Here's what your writing is like to me. Here's where you're really strong, where you did really well. Here's where you need to focus. Why did you say this? You may want to think of this. Same in mathematics. Same in science. Same in English language. All the subjects. That to me is what separates a really high quality professional teacher, the ability to know what feedback to give. And again, that all gets back to relationships. If we know our students really well, we're going to give more targeted feedback. We're going to give more expert feedback than otherwise.
We're talking to educator Tony Gerlich. Now, what you just said about feedback makes me think about the life of a teacher and the teacher's day. the kind of teacher that you want, is it built into their 8-hour teaching day to be able to sit quietly with their students' papers and not be teaching and not be doing other administrative responsibilities? Or is that kind of like their homework that they have to take home with them at night and do extra overtime work?
I think I understand your question to mean, does a teacher have enough time and support during the day to do what I was just describing?
Correct.
Right. It's a great question. There are many, many, too many demands on all of us as educators, in my view. Teachers, administrators, everyone in the system has a lot to do. And that is why I'm a fan of smaller class sizes as well. Because I think to provide that level of individualization, to provide that level of individual feedback, a teacher needs many fewer students. Now, there are some teachers in our public school system right now that are over 150 kids. It's very hard to do that on a daily basis, regularly, with 150 kids or more, even. I think we're under stress in that regard. That is a reality. New Mexico is no different than other states that are facing the same budgetary constraints, the same increased class sizes across the board. But nonetheless, it doesn't still get away from or take away from the value of all of those things happening in a classroom. We just have to be creative about doing that, even with those increased numbers.
The whole educational system nationally is under so much of a burden of the movement to decrease taxes, which means that there is less public money for things like education, and that puts a burden on teachers and students and facilities and administrators and everybody. You, as a school principal, as an educator, teachers are put in the problem of having to absorb the burdens of massive underfunding and, frankly, lack of focus on the importance of education in this country. How do you take that on?
What a question, Mary Charlotte, and a good one, again. I don't think there is a lack of attention to education in our country. I think education is getting more attention now than it has been in the last... And that's been true every year for the last 20 years. When you and I were growing up, there really wasn't a national focus on education.
But it was so much better. I mean, we never had this thing where we were expected to fundraise for our own schools or bring in our own art supplies. I mean, we had music and PE and art and a complete educational picture. And it was okay for parents to just send their kids to school.
That's right. I can't disagree with that. I think that we are under more stress in our system, and I think it's not necessarily about education alone. I think our entire society is under far more stress than ever before. And we know the statistics about the economic spread in our country. We know that the United States educates the masses of its citizens far more than most any other country in the world. And we
what
know
do you mean by more?
I think the United States has a higher commitment to educating all of its citizens, regardless of their economic status, than most countries in the world. That's been my experience.
Than Europe?
Yeah. I don't think that Europe has the level of poverty of its students that we have. I think the United States ranks number 15 of the top 15 industrialized nations in the number of children that are in poverty. Europe does not face that stress that we do, and there's plenty of examples of people and students getting left behind in a whole host of European educational systems. Now, there is a tension there, too. They are having those exact same conversations about how they're educating the folks that are left behind. How are they educating the massive amounts of immigrants that European nations are now confronting? And that's a new phenomenon for Europe, whereas in the United States, I'm not saying that we've done a great job of it, but we've focused some attention on it far longer than European nations have.
One of the ongoing conversations in New Mexico is why we do so poorly in comparison to the rest of the country. What do you think is going on in New Mexico?
I think much of what is happening in New Mexico, as well as across the United States, teachers are asked to oftentimes perform miracles that are not necessarily of an educational domain. All of society's ills present themselves at the education doorstep and in the classroom. And teachers cannot solve all of those problems. Schools cannot solve all of those problems. It really does take, as cliche as it sounds, an entire village to raise a child. It's not at all surprising that high performance correlates with lower levels of poverty and dispossessiveness and trauma. And I want to emphasize that it's not about poverty alone. And that is a misnomer. And when educators say that it's about poverty, I would tend to disagree with that. We have many, many examples of kids that are learning, of schools that are functioning in high poverty situations. But they take different routes and they take different ways of doing things. And one thing that I will acknowledge is that the trauma that comes with poverty, I think, is great. The trauma, by that I mean, are children coming to school hungry? Do they witness violence in the home? Are there multiple partners in the home? Is there food insecurity at home? Is there on and on? Now, all of those are traumatic experiences. People can be living in poverty and be in a home full of love and support and do fine. But trauma does present itself with increased variables for educators to overcome. And in New Mexico, I don't have the trauma statistics, but we certainly have the poverty statistics, and we're higher than most states. In fact, we're higher, I think, than 48 other states. So that's clearly one factor that's happening. Education is underfunded in New Mexico, as it is across the states, and I think our teachers deserve to get paid more. All of our educators are doing the work that moves our society forward and need to get remunerated higher so that New Mexico can be competitive. So there's an entire systems look on that. Nobody's going to argue with the fact that we need to pay teachers more, but where's that money going to come from? How are we going to fund that system? And then how are we going to make sure that the monies that we are spending are actually working? So, complicated problem.
Well, and it gets back to taxation and this sort of anti-taxation sentiment that has been kind of pounded into our heads over the last several decades, as if your taxes weren't going to something productive.
It takes a whole village to raise a child. When there's a perception that our schools are not doing well, I think folks, particularly that do not have children, may be more reticent to approve tax levies and tax bonds. But the health of any community depends on a vibrant educational system. I mean, here in Santa Fe, we have a young, vibrant, dynamic superintendent who has taken some bold steps and moves, and I think the community is very supportive of moving this system forward and moving our district forward in light of the problems. And that's the other thing that inspires me, Mary Charlotte. It's easy to list a whole list of reasons of why things are not working. The greatest teachers are the ones that say, well, it is what it is. We're moving forward regardless. Here's what we're going to do regardless.
Speaking of which, you are opening a new school, the Mandela International Magnet School. Now, what is a magnet school?
A magnet school is true to its metaphor. A school is placed in the district and then operates as a magnet that draws students to come to it. It is a public school of choice. Like a charter school, students and families can choose to come to the magnet school, or they can choose not to come to the magnet school. It's their choice. Difference, and a major difference between a magnet and a charter, is that this particular magnet has the strong support of the superintendent, the school board, and the district. And I find that inspiring, actually. I find that very exciting. It's a school of choice with district support. And having founded a school of choice completely on our own and with the struggles of getting up and off the ground and running, I deeply appreciate that support.
What grade levels are we talking about?
We're going to open in grades 7 and 8, keeping it small, with 50 students in each grade. So 100 students in our first year, and that will begin this August. And then we will move those students up and add a new 7th grade. They all move up, move and add another 7th grade until we're 7 through 12 and about 300 students. Now that's plus or minus. We may add some, but we're not going to get very big, and we certainly will not broach 360 or 400 students. We will remain small.
Where will it be housed?
This is a another advantage that a magnet school has over a charter, in that being in the district provides facilities. And in this particular case, we will be housed in a wing off of the DeVargas Middle School building site. It's a wonderful middle school. It's very nicely laid out and done. There is a wing on the southwest side that we can occupy. It has a separate entrance, and it's going to be a lovely place. The principal at DeVargas, Mark Ducharme, has been wonderful to work with in sharing that facility. We're going to co-share some of their facilities. And so our students, for example, being a magnet school from all over the city, DeVargas has a wonderful athletic complex, great field, great gymnasium. They have a wonderful orchestra and choir there. That's going to be made available to us. We have some professional development that we have garnered ourselves with a particular grant that we're going to offer to DeVargas, to Mark and his staff. So it's that kind of a sharing relationship that I think is, it's a positive thing. It's not a us, they, or either, or. It's a both and in that case.
Now, when you have a magnet school, a charter school, a school of choice, first of all, how do people get into it? Can anybody go who wants to go?
Good question again. The answer is yes. We have decided, we being myself, the superintendent, and the school board, who voted on the admissions procedures, that the school admissions will be by lottery. And I like that. I like that a great deal. And I like it because I think the IB presents a unique philosophy. It's a wonderful philosophy. It's a very holistic approach to learning. It's a very thinking curriculum. It ought to be made available to everybody, regardless of where they live. And so we have established a lottery system that I think is unique. And we're going to have 5 zones created throughout Santa Fe, one zone that corresponds to every school board member's district. And I have been going around the community of Santa Fe making presentations. I have a few more to give this week and until Friday, which is the deadline for the lottery. And we will take
this
all
coming Friday?
This coming Friday is the deadline for the applications.
Okay.
That's right. And so those addresses will be placed in those zones. And if they're out of the zone or out of the district, they have a separate category. And we'll have 5 simultaneous selections within those zones, and that's going to ensure geographic diversity throughout the city, and I think that's marvelous.
So you're going to get 1/5 south side kids, 1/5 east side, north, whatever, however it's divided up.
And it won't be that clean and neat, because there's a proportionality. There are some of those zones that have more students, but proportionally it'll be equitable.
Now, when you have charter schools and magnet schools, and people want to go to them because they think their kids will get a better education, or the kids think that they will get out of a kind of bully hell or whatever it is that they're in their public school, what happens if you have a situation where all the motivated kids and kids whose parents are motivated on their behalf are all going to these special public schools? Who's left in the regular public schools?
I'm familiar with that that argument and that criticism, actually, that's been leveled against charter schools. And the reality is there are some charter schools that have tried to do that. They are in the vast minority, however. The majority
have tried to take the best students, quote,
well,
unquote,
or tried to advertise themselves as strictly college prep. Do not come here unless you're college prep. Or only come here if you're academically motivated, etc., etc. They can advertise themselves that way, which then would lead to a self-selection of some folks. That has happened. Being the former director of the Charter School Bureau here, whenever we found that occurring, we intervened to try to make the admissions requirements of all charter schools as equitable as possible for everyone and not exclusionary. And I'd have to say, Mary Charlotte, that the largest inspiration that I have seen here in New Mexico comes from the many, many charter schools who are dealing with the population of kids that the traditional system has not worked for. We have many schools that are dropout recovery schools that are functioning well in bringing kids back into the system. Some terrific inspirations. We have a charter school in the Municipal Detention Center in Albuquerque, where the average age of the high school student is 22 years old, where there's some visionary educators, Greta Roskam, who had this brilliant idea of creating a high school for those kids who have been thrown away by our society and bringing them back. So are there charter schools that cream some of the students? I'm sure there are. I know there are. But they're far, far less than those charter schools that are truly doing what their mission is, and that's to educate everybody. And I can tell you, at Monte del Sol, we had an amazing diverse population right from the get-go. And part of that is because we recruited in those neighborhoods. We recruited everywhere. And the joy there was that we had some undocumented families sitting side by side with families from the Eastside Hills. And they were on the soccer fields together. And that, to me, was...
Which equalizes everybody.
Which equalizes everybody. Right?
Why is the school named after Nelson Mandela?
For a number of reasons. Number one, he is a personal hero of mine, but that's way down on the list. The more important reason is that the values that Mandela holds true are the values that we will aspire to hold true in the school as well. Nelson Mandela was very well known for saying that education is the most powerful weapon we can use to change the world. He had numerous opportunities for violence. In his early days, he actually went there a little bit. But he had the opportunity for much greater use of violence, and he turned to education and nonviolence as a way to accomplish what he has accomplished. So the values that he espouses of inclusion, diversity, education, resilience, perseverance, vision are all the values that we hold dear in the school. In addition to that, when Mandela was in prison, he sent his three daughters out of South Africa, away from that system of education, to a United World College in Swaziland, which the United World Colleges have adopted the IB right from their inception as international schools.
Right.
And he called that curriculum and that school a curriculum that teaches kids how to think, and it's a school that was a beacon of freedom. And he was very enamored of that philosophy of education. And when he left prison finally, he became president of the United World College movement. Granted, it was an honorary presidency, but he really espoused the values that the IB espouses and that we espouse at the school. So for all those reasons, he's a terrific model for all of us. And I, in the later years of my life, hold him up as a model equally as I hope our 12, 13, 14, and 15-year-olds hold up as a model.
Well, anyone who can be in prison for decades and be unfailingly polite to his or her captors is certainly a model for me. It's more than most of us probably could or would do under those circumstances.
That power of forgiveness is very, very powerful. You know, he took one of his jailers and made him ambassador to Switzerland. How about that for forgiveness?
Now, before we go, it's also going to be a bilingual program, is that correct?
I don't use the term bilingual, but I will use the term dual language and components of dual language in there. As we are recruiting all over the city, we very much hope to get a native Spanish-speaking population in the school. If we get them in sufficient numbers, then we will offer two content areas instruction in Spanish. Spanish language arts, which is analogous to English language arts for English language folks, and also social studies taught in Spanish to them. And the idea there is that we not only honor the language, but we perfect that language in its reading, in its writing, in its comprehension, and elevate the use of Spanish and elevate the use of English together. That's our dream and our goal at the Mandela International School. And so we're hiring appropriately right now for that purpose. The other thing that's intriguing, that if we can pull that off, students can actually graduate with an IB diploma that says bilingual diploma on it. And that's not very easy to do, but it's a wonderful goal to set out for us all.
Now, the deadline for applications is this Friday, so if anybody is listening who wants to apply or let young people know about it, it's applications for the 7th and 8th grade. How do they apply?
Great. You can do it electronically is the easiest way. www.sfps.info/MIMS, M-I-M-S, which stands for Mandela International Magnet School. Go to that website and scroll slightly down and you'll see application link, and it's very, very easy.
SFPS, that stands for Santa Fe Public School, sfps.info/MIMS, M-I-M-S.
Correct. And if for folks do not have internet, they can stop by the administrative office of the Santa Fe Public Schools, ask for an application, fill it out by hand, and it'll get to me. The deadline is Friday at 5 p.m.
Tony Gerlich is a longtime educator. He's founder of the Monte del Sol Charter School, and he's the new principal learner at the Mandela International Magnet School. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.